The idea behind Citizen Friday was repair, share, and get some fresh air. So the idea was that on Black Friday itself, don't go consume, go and do these things instead. They're better for your community, they're better for you, and they're better for the environment. And actually, like, the whole campaign went down really, really well. And I think it's because it was quite simple to be involved. You could take part in it. You had a role to play, and has caught the attention of people just because of the situation we are in the world at the minute. And maybe people don't have as much expendable cash and spend as much money to spend and stuff, so they fancy doing something maybe a bit different. Like, maybe they want to do something that's a bit more for them or for their community. And it went really, really well, and it's continued since.
Today I'm joined by Gavin Ferney-Jones, a remarkable individual whose life story is a testament to embracing change, resilience, and the power of community. He discovered his love for the outdoors as he grew up in the Peak District in the UK, but ended up in the French Alps managing chalets before his entrepreneurial spirit led him to open a ski boot fitting business. But as he witnessed the creeping realities of climate change emerge all around him, he began to take action through his One Tree at a Time initiative. This led to further initiatives like Citizen Fridays and now his growing Reaction Collective. As a self-described reluctant leader, Gavin is actually a proactive change maker. Through initiatives like Citizen Fridays and the engaging community space that champion sustainability, Gavin and his team are not only talking about change, they're living it. This is a conversation about transformation and is proof that we can all take action, make choices, have an impact, and contribute to a more sustainable future. I hope that you're inspired as much as I was. Now, over to Gavin. Gavin, welcome to the Impossible Network.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me here. It's lovely to be talking to you today.
And you are talking from where exactly?
I'm talking from a small village in the French Alps called Le Grenier, right on the edge of a larger ski resort called Courchevel.
Well, let's jump in. We've established what you're doing at the moment. We're going to get more into that. But let's start with a big question. Who are you as a human being?
Yeah, you did send some questions over, and I have to say I was a bit uncomfortable with this one. And mainly because I think I may be a human being that's in transition. I am a very different person to what I was 8 years ago. I've had some pretty fundamental changes happen in the last 8 years of my life. And I think those changes, some of those to my family, to my work and my career, some of those changes also to the environment I live in. And I think that means I have maybe become a bit of a reluctant leader, I think. I wouldn't have imagined 8 years ago that I would sit on a podcast and talk to you. And that's been an interesting journey, actually. It's been quite eye-opening. I've definitely forced myself into some more uncomfortable positions in the last few years and challenged myself. I am, by nature, quite empathetic. And I think that has played into the role I've now taken on in the last few years and helped me massively with that. I'm a family man, so I've got two young children now, husband, and I'm in a place where I'm very, very happy and quite positive, which can sometimes feel unusual considering the sector I'm sort of working in and the stuff I'm learning about.
It's an interesting term, a reluctant leader. Before getting into why you've become a reluctant leader and why you're in this period of transition, the second question I'd like to explore is what made you you, or who made you you?
I mean, this question's like quite easy, actually. And I think my parents, really, for me, are the reason that I am who I am. And actually, I can probably even define that down to one decision that my parents made when I was around about 10. When I was born, we lived in Essex, well, just on the edge of Essex, in a town called Bishop Stortford, so just north of London.
Oh, yeah.
And my mum worked at a bank as a cashier, and my dad was a mechanic on lorries. And they'd always, from their childhood, gone to this organization called the Woodcraft Folk, which is a group a bit like the Girl Guides and the Scouts, but it's for both male and female. And it sort of came out of the labor movement in the 60s. So it's got a lot of, it's embedded in stuff like woodcraft, in the outdoors, in nature. And they'd always attended these groups. And these groups would go on residentials to the Peak District. And they went to one particular center that's called Lockerbrook. And when I was 10, my mum and dad decided that they would apply for the job to run the center in the Peak District. So we left Essex and left our area and moved to the Peaks, which at the time, being 10, I thought it was crazy.
Yeah.
I had, I had a group of friends. I was in school and all that got like taken out, like changed. Everything changed really. We went then. I think the biggest change is that we moved to this outdoor center that it's up on the Snake Pass. I think it's actually the UK's highest residential building. I'm pretty sure it is. Or not the UK, but certainly England's. And at the outdoor center, our next neighbor was a mile away and the nearest village was 15 miles away. So
your friend network became a bunch of squirrels.
Sheep, my brothers.
Yeah. Well, that is a significant change. What about siblings?
Yeah, I've got two brothers. And actually, on this note, my mum has asked me a couple of times recently a really strange question. Like, it isn't a strange question because it must have been playing on their mind when they made this decision as to whether it was the right thing to do. And my mum was like, oh, so when we moved to Lockerbrook, that was the right decision. I was like, are you mad? It was the best decision, like, ever. Like, bar none. Like, we ended up living in this incredible part of the world, outdoor most of the time, my brother's playing. In outdoor centres, so you had lots of different people coming every week. So there's constant stream of groups coming through. I got qualified as a climbing instructor, so a few years of instructing in the Peak District, which was like a fantastic job to be doing. Like outside all the time, the most amazing natural playground to go and play with my brothers. So yeah, she obviously means something to her because she keeps asking me again, was it the right decision? They must have been really weighing it up as to whether to do it at the time. And I'm like, it's one of those moments. I can't imagine what I would have become if I had stayed down south, because I don't think we would have got into like the outdoor sports. Yeah.
That's incredible. Why did they decide to do it? Was it for your benefit, children's benefit? Or did they have a hankering to live in the outdoors, the wilds? Because that's a radical change, a pivot for them, from a mechanic and a cashier to suddenly uproot their life and go to make such a dramatic life change.
And when they went to this centre, they went to a centre that was just a residential centre, really struggling to make ends meet. They went, and then my dad got qualified really quickly in all the outdoor sports like caving, canoeing, kayaking, climbing, introduced outdoor sports to the centre. So before it was just a place where you'd go in and stay and you'd just play in the outdoors around it. And then he got qualified and started to offer the groups those sort of activities. So it's like a massive leap from, like I say, from a key mechanic and cashier to something really, really different. And I mean, they had to do some pretty big bits of driving for us and stuff, for example, because they always said that when they'd moved there, they would never let it impinge on what we wanted to do. So if I wanted to do a sports club, which was around the valley in Hope Valley, 25 miles away, they were just like, yeah. And if that meant staying after school, my dad would come and get me in the, I know now, like it had a mile long track up to it, like a really rough track that was self-maintained by the center. So it was really rough. We had to do a lot of work on it all the time, but it had four gates on it. And I always think to myself, the amount of times my dad must have stopped to open that gate, to drive through, to close that gate, to go and do the next one, to just come and pick me up from like football club or something. So like, yeah, wow. That must have been massively pivotal in my life, because they introduced me to the outdoors, which I just wouldn't have.
So that love of the outdoors, how did it play a significant part? I've interviewed a number of people that have grown up in the different wilds of countryside and gone on to very different careers. So your path has been very much focused on the outdoors and adventure, sports and skiing, I suppose, snowboarding. Why that path?
I think some of it might be tied up in the physical sports itself. So if you take like the sport of climbing in the Peak District, it's quite an unusual sport in the Peak District, because it's really, really short climbs, but it's not protected. So if you're climbing here in the Alps, there's bolts that you can clip into. It's a safety, like screwed into the rock. In the Peak District, because of the nature of the rock, you place your own gear. So you'll put like a nut in a crack, or a friend, just like a camming device in a crack. And some of the stuff's just unprotectable. So you're climbing, all right, small heights up to like 25 meters, but unprotectable. So, and the landing area isn't flat. It's a boulder field. So I think I learned a hell of a lot from some of those outdoor sports like climbing. I started to understand my limits or my capabilities, or how to get myself in the right frame of mind to maybe tackle a dangerous and difficult climb at like quite a young age. Mm-hmm. And I guess I had quite a lot of freedom from my parents. I would have been up there with my brothers at the age of 16, 17, 18, like teaching ourselves how to climb. Like my dad would give us some tips from his instructor and stuff, but there was a certain amount of letting us go and go and learn from it. So I think those outdoor sports, they do prepare you well for life in a way. They do challenge you. They do make you understand risk.
I suppose it makes you confront your fear and know your limits of where your fear limit is.
Yeah. And people would say, I guess, with climbers and especially looking at like professional climbers now that are doing some really, really crazy soloing on places like El Capitan and stuff.
Alex Honnold and Free Solo.
Yeah.
Incredible watching him. And
it's crazy and incredible watching him, but I know that he knows he can do that. And I know that he's been through the training and got to that level and he is confident and comfortable that he can do that. And I wasn't soloing anywhere near that level, but I was definitely soloing. And you approach it and you train and you work towards that level. And to what someone else might think, you're doing something that somebody else might think is really, really crazy, but actually you know in your mind that you can do it. So you do it. And I think some of that is really, really useful for the rest of your life. Like it's a good grounding and a good bed for what you go on to do. Other than that, I just love being outdoors.
You said if you can't imagine where you would be now if your parents hadn't made that switch and they'd stayed in Bishop Stortford and you'd grown up outside North London and in a suburban environment. Do you recall what it was like before you moved to the Peak District? If you had an adventurous sort of attitude to life, were you always out in the outdoors, even there with your friends, getting into mischief?
Oh, I've always liked sports. So when we were living in Bishop Stortford, I can remember playing rugby every Sunday, and like me and both my brothers are quite small, and we must have got run over quite a few times playing rugby, and definitely wasn't a natural rugby player, but I still loved it, and we got soaking wet and freezing cold every Sunday and still went and did it. So I definitely had that affinity for just being outdoors and games. And then I guess having two brothers, like, yeah, when we were in Bishop Stortford, the house we had there actually had a big field behind it, and we were always out in the field building dens and playing. And I think if I'd have been a single child and moved to Lockbrook in the Peak District, it would have been a very different experience to the one of having that journey with two brothers, because you've got two mates to go and play with after school every day. So
let's go on to the big question of what you're working to achieve or impact as a reluctant leader. A long way to go before you shuffle off this mortal coil. Having listened to a couple of your podcasts, or a few of your podcasts before and spoken to you, clearly you went down a path, not of free soloing, mountaineering, but you found yourself in the mountains of Europe skiing. And I think that's where you met your wife, Leif Sarah, took you on the sort of the path to where you are. So perhaps you could just chart that little journey.
Yeah, sure. I've got one of my brothers to thank for this journey, actually. He came out to the French Alps to a ski resort that's part of Courchevel called Latagne, and he came out to work in the chalet company. He did that for a season, and on the very last week of the season, I just said, oh, I'll come out with a mate and see what this is all about, like, what's it like? And me and this mate went out, and I was just instantly taken aback by it, and I just instantly knew I wanted to live there within a week. And the following year, I came out with my brother to run a chalet in the same chalet company, and we did that together for a year. So that was getting up, cooking breakfast to guests in the morning, skiing all day, and then it's cooking dinner at night and partying all night, to be honest. I actually went on to do that for 5 years all in. And then I met Sarah, my wife, here on the very first day we got here. She worked for the same company. After 4 years of being together, we decided to go to Canada for a season. So we went to work in Banff. Well, actually, we went to go work in a town called Fernie, because Sarah's surname is Fernie. That's where the Fernie Jones comes from in my name. So we went to go work in Fernie, got there, couldn't find any jobs. I had a mate who was working in Banff in a ski boot fitting shop. And he said, oh, I've got a job available here. Do you want to come work here? And I was like, yeah, cool. That's great. So I managed to get a waiting on job. And so we did a year in Banff, which was really, really cool. And I learned how to fit ski boots. At the same time, I had a mate in Courchevel who made skis. So he made skis from scratch. He built all the tooling and all the kit to be able to make these skis. And we just kept having a conversation and said, well, what about setting up a boot shop in in the French Alps because like there's nothing in Courchevel. Web business plan, got a friend whose dad was quite high up in BA and said, I'll read through your business plan for you. And he read through it and said, it's good. It makes sense. Like, yeah, like give it a go. And we gave it a go and opened that shop and another one and run those two shops for 10 years, which...
Wow. First of all, ski boot fitting. Don't you just put your foot in a ski boot and that's it? You strap them in and off you go.
Yeah, they're notoriously uncomfortable. The reason being is you've got like you're trying to do something quite difficult. You're trying to connect a body to a plastic product that's then attached to a ski that's, you know, up to 1 meter, not 80, 1 meter, 90. And then you're going to ski down the hill with lots of forces and lots of stuff going on. Really what you need to do in boot fit is you need to stop that foot from moving. Because as soon as that foot starts to move, you're going to get blisters. You're going to bang the end of your toe and your toenail will fall off. So actually what you need to do in the ski boot is you need to stabilize the foot with a custom made footbed. And then you need to get that foot into quite a well-fitted tight boot. Now, normally when people try that sort of boot on, they won't buy it. They'll buy the size up, just go straight from the size up. And once you start moving around in a ski boot, it's actually very, very difficult to keep someone comfortable.
Wow. That explains a lot of my experience skiing then, now that I know that.
What it was as well is an incredible problem-solving experience. So you've got to sit in front of the customer. You're going to take lots of measurements to their foot. You're going to look at their anatomy, and lots of people are going to, their feet and their body is going to be structured very differently. They're going to have wider feet, or they're going to have collapsed arches, or they're going to have all sorts of things going on. You're going to make a boot that fits them, but then when they leave that shop space, you have no control over how they ski. So they can go and ski really, really quite out of position, for example, like really backseat in the ski, and their toes are going to push against the front, and they might ski really badly, or they might really over tighten the boots. And so they're going to come back to you, because the service that we offered was like a guarantee. So you come back and we will make sure that boot fits. And that's what the customer trusted us for. And they got it for. So they come back a lot. So you've got a problem solve, a lot of issues that might be slightly out of your hands, always in front of a customer. So it's very like you sat down in front of a customer for 9-10 hours a day, customer facing, lots of conversations. Probably where my, over that time, probably where I've become less, I'm less reluctant now to talk to people or do things like a podcast, probably because I've spent so much time in the last 10 years sat face to face with all sorts of people discussing their feet.
Courchevel is probably one of the most desirable and affluent ski resorts in Europe. Why wasn't there a boot fitting service there already?
Around, like, so in Courchevel, there's a lot of rental shops, and renting a ski and a ski boot is much easier. Than fitting a ski boot. Like, for example, some of the skis that these companies will be renting, they will be paying 150 to 200 euros. They will rent them out for 100 euros for a week. So within a week within 2 weeks of renting out that ski, you're starting to turn a profit. And it's much easier money. Like, the boot fits and you've got to be trained. You've got to have a lot of experience. You've got to be willing for those customers to come back to you with complaints because they will do. And you've got to be willing to deal with that. And I just think it's far easier to rent someone a ski and not to have to deal with that problem. So it kind of worked, because a lot of shops were quite grateful we were there. We weren't renting out ski boots and skis, so we weren't crossing over on their business.
I see. So it was complementary to the existing businesses.
Yeah, very cool.
Fascinating. So that took you on that path to entrepreneurship and probably a fantastic lifestyle and meeting and engaging interesting people. A lot of the time, what was the pivotal moment that began that transition to you becoming this reluctant leader?
I think there's maybe one big one that we'll go on to in a minute, but I also think there's been a drip feed of actions or going-ons in my community, in my part of the world, that have fed into me wanting to change what I do. By that drip feed, I mean the changes we can see in our community, in our landscape, in our environment from climate change. So the boot shop was based at the height of 1650. So it's in a ski resort called 1650. So that's 1,650 meters above sea level. I worked in that shop for 10 years and I'd lived in the resort at that height for another five. And actually during those 15 years, you could see the impacts of climate change. The main one being that it would rain a lot more over snow, and so the temperature would rise. It'd cause it to rain a lot more. Around us as well, at the same time, we've obviously got glacial melt going on, and like pretty much incomprehensible rate, to be honest. In some places, up to 18 meters of depth from glacier can be lost in a year.
So you can actually witness it and see it on the mountain? that melt?
Places like Chamonix, you can clearly see it because there's the Mer de Glace, which is a really famous glacier that you can ski down. And at the bottom of there, there's a set of steps that take you up to the station that takes you down, back down the valley. And you can, as you walk down the steps, they've got the high marks of where the snow was by year. And it's not on the steps anymore. We're talking hundreds and hundreds of steps. And then I'm a bit lucky that I've got a bit of land with the house that we own. And we like to try and grow a bit of food. We've got some cherry trees, some apple trees, some pear trees. We've got a veg patch. And so I spend a lot of my time outside, both skiing in the winter, but also in the summer, just probably a bit slower paced life, but just out there doing bits and pieces in the garden. And it's just becoming progressively harder to farm that space because it's drying out. So it's pretty hot. Last year, for example, we didn't have a single piece of fruit on this side of the valley. The blossom came up pretty early. We had a bit of a frost, but also we had a lot of pillars for some reason last year, whether that's to do with the biodiversity getting knocked out of sync a little bit. And yeah, so it had all these like drip feed things going on that you keep seeing, and you start to realize that climate change is having quite a big impact on your region and on your community. And I guess that started to make me think about what I was doing and what my role was in society and what I was doing in my community and what my job was actually. So I'd grown up in the Peak District, where it was all about being in the outdoors, climbers by the nature, and me and my brothers and kids as climbers, like super frugal. Like if we went climbing to Europe somewhere, we did it on absolute shoestring. Whereas Courchevel is the opposite of that. It is luxury.
opulence, yeah.
It doesn't get more opulent, to be honest. And I think, I don't know, I just don't think I felt that comfortable in, you know, that role of just buying products and selling products. Like I started to question myself as to what my role is in society and what I was doing. Was it, I guess, worthwhile, or was it important? Could I do something else? That had been playing on my mind for a bit. We'd done a few bits at the ski shop, like we'd addressed like some of the single-use plastic in the ski shop, and we'd start to do as much as we could within that organization when it came to thinking about its environmental impact. And then kind of got to a bit of a barrier really, which was talking to the suppliers of the gear, realizing that they weren't particularly forward-thinking in their approach and didn't have particularly any ideas, to be honest, about where they were going to go. Had a couple of reps that were really good reps, actually, for a couple of the brands. And one of them was he was a fly fisherman, and he'd been part of a group that was suing the town of Annecy and the sewage works had been overflowing into the river so many times a year because basically it wasn't of a big enough scale to serve the town anymore because the town had kept expanding. And so he was quite frank when I'd asked him, like, what is the brand doing? And he'd be like, the brand's doing nothing. Like, they're not anything in the pipeline. I remember one year he was really excited to go, Gavin, we put like a, you know, they take us away for an evening once a year and show us a few things and show us next year's products. And he was like, oh, this year there's a slide about sustainability. And like, it was a slide about placing the plastic wrapping on the skis with cardboard, which isn't really going to make a difference. And the kind of strange thing with it as well is it was replaced with cardboard, and then they wrapped around the ski two plastic ski Velcro bands that would hold the two skis would hold it all together. So there was two of those on there. There was probably as much plastic in the two wraps that went round the cardboard as there was in the original plastic film that was on the product. So it's these kind of conversations where you were talking to brands and going nowhere.
Everyone is aware, whether it be you witnessing what's happening within the supply chain and the industry that you're in, the tourists and the people that are coming to the resort are probably abundantly aware. Also, because they're on the mountain, they're probably coming back year after year. They can see the impact of climate change. Everyone's probably aware, but people feel helpless and hopeless in terms of what do they do? What difference can one person make? And most people then just resign themselves to just carry on with their lives and maybe make some small incremental changes. You could have done the same thing. Did you feel a sense of urgency or a desire to do something?
Yeah. No, I don't feel a sense of urgency, which is strange because for a sport like skiing, the urgency is, this should be there. Everyone should be acting urgency. And in fact, like some of those same suppliers will be quite open about the fact that what they're actually going to do is take as much money out of the system before skiing ends, as part of, like, take as much as possible. that's their company's decisions and their decisions. Why I changed, I don't know. It could have been pretty easy for me, to be honest, to just continue doing what we're doing. Like, the boot lab worked. We made some pretty big changes to staffing hours after COVID, which meant we had 3-hour lunches, which is it's great. That's very French, which meant I could go skiing every day. I would work for the winter and then I wouldn't have to work for the summer. That was enough money from the winter trade to not have to work in the summer. So yeah, at times I do think I could have opted for the easy life in some ways and continued doing that. But I just guess as I start to learn more about climate change and understand the impacts and see the impacts, it's harder to just hide and say, no, I'm just going to continue. I just became less comfortable in that idea of just continuing. I have transitioned to something slightly different and I haven't completed that transition yet. There's still some crucial bits missing in that process, like funding. But I understand, like from my friends and other people in the industry that are embedded into the industry that have money invested in something, like, for example, they might have the rental of a shop contract signed for the next 5 or 10 years, or they might have a long-term mortgage on that shop space. They don't really have an option to leave and move into something else. They're kind of stuck in that role. And even if they did want to go and do something else, that's not really the pathway at the minute to do that. I did write a blog recently about the ski industry and about the direction we're going, in the hope that some of those people would start to think about the direction that we're heading in, and maybe it might give them a bit of an impetus to sort of start to think about the change and start to think what might come next. And I think there's also something fairly crucial in this debate that has masked the impact of climate change, and that's fake snow. Now, in places like Italy, 90% of the snow that is on the piste is from snow cannons. So if you took snow cannons out of the Italian ski resorts, you'd have 10% of the snow they've currently got.
And presumably 30, 40 years ago, they didn't need those snow cannons.
Yeah, exactly. So before they didn't need them. Like now you couldn't, these places couldn't exist without them. And so I think when you talk about like people see the impact, some of the impact has been masked because you can go and there's these snow cannons that have made the snow so it doesn't look as bad as it would look if those snow cannons weren't there right now. I think this year or the last couple of years, certainly amongst my friends and colleagues and people in the community, the conversations are much more open. It's things like climate change are discussed a lot more openly. It's more acceptable to talk about it. And I'd say the same is for people coming to resort, like clients and guests. I'd say like it's more acceptable topic. What I would say is that there's very little examples of it, of people changing what they do because of it. Like this is half term here at the moment. So it's the busiest week of the holidays. The helicopter transferring people from the airport to the resort hasn't stopped flying for the last 3 or 4 days because people want to avoid the transfer on the road. So yeah, people, I think, understand the problems a lot more, but it's hard at the minute to see much change in how people are acting.
Well, perhaps you could explain or give a insight into the actions you have taken that started with your One Tree at a Time and has led you to the Reaction Collective.
Yeah, so five years ago now, we decided to hold a repair day out the front of the ski shop. It was actually the very first Brexit day. So Brexit is obviously a bit of a contentious event for us because none of us knew whether we were really truly going to be able to stay here. We had an idea that we would.
Of course, because you're a British citizen. So you must have been questioning. Yeah, interesting.
Questioning, and a strange thing to experience when the country you're growing up with, it feels like the country you're growing up doesn't want to be part of your life in a way. It's a bit odd thing to say, but it's like it wants to extract itself from your life. It's a strange thing to say, I suppose, but there's just like a bit of a sense of that. So yeah, we decided to do something positive on that day. We thought, we'll do a repair day. We'll do something that just felt good. And in resort, it was a really quiet week because there was people thinking that the flights would be grounded and like you wouldn't be able to get back from resort. So actually a lot of people didn't book to come that week. So we just thought we'd do something cool. And we held a repair day. And in the run up to the repair day, I asked all my friends a couple of weeks before, I said, do you want to bring any kit that you don't use, like any snowboard trousers, ski boots, jackets you don't use? And what we'll do is we'll just sell them on the day and we'll take any money we fundraise from that and we'll put it towards some tree planting. that was kind of a big trigger, because some of my friends and colleagues and stuff start turning up with like 4 spare jackets, 5 spare ski pants, and something about this huge selection of clothing.
Wow.
Just kicking around in people's wardrobes. Tons of it. We sold it on the day and raised 9,000 euros. So that kind of got us thinking as well, was like, wow, there's all this stuff
that otherwise might have ended up in landfill.
Yeah, I mean, it will end up in landfill, and probably worse than that, actually. Probably get shipped great distances before that happens. Like, probably get shipped to places like Ghana before it then ends up in landfill or incineration. Like, I'm sure we'll come on to this later, but the carbon footprint of a piece of clothing at the end of life is still pretty monumental after that point. So we did that, and then at the same time, we'd been doing bits and pieces to the boot lab, to the businesses, and there was other businesses locally that were asking, like, oh, like, we like what you're doing. Is there a way to get involved? So we set up an organization called One Tree at a Time, which runs here in our community. We now have a community space, and we do all sorts of things from that space. We have film nights, we teach sewing classes, bicycle repair workshops on how to make your organizations and company more sustainable, training with different staff members and stuff. And we did that, and that space has been open now for 4 years, and it's completely self-funded. So it's totally funded from the waste in our community. Like, we didn't have to take any loans out or find any money to set that up. We managed to do it with the stuff that was all this waste that people were throwing out. And it's become like this really, really special place locally. So we make quite a lot of our funds. We raise quite a lot of our funds from selling used ski instructor uniforms. So a ski instructor might ski in a jacket for 1 or 2 seasons. And then, to be honest, at that point, that jacket probably is no longer suitable or waterproof for a ski instructor to turn up looking professional and to remain dry. I get it a bit why it wouldn't necessarily work for them, but that doesn't mean it wouldn't work for someone like myself who lives here, who on a rainy day probably would choose not to go skiing. Like, I would probably choose to do something else. And so we started to get this quite good quality gear that had been used for a period of time. Some of those instructor uniforms as well would be for like at half term or Easter, you would have some extra instructors come in, like from Italy, for example. A lot of Italians come in the half term and Easter. They're part-timers. They come in to fill in the really busy periods. They would obviously need a uniform as well. So that uniform would be lightly used. And we started to patch over the logos, because they don't want those uniforms out in the community, because someone might be skiing in them badly, like, and they're meant to be a ski. This is a recognizable ski school or ski instructor outfit. They might be in a bar acting badly, kind of thing. So there was this, the brands and the organizations weren't keen on having that product out in the community. So what we did was we literally started patching over the logos and reselling them, which has been really good in 2 ways. Obviously, it's kept a hell of a lot of product out of landfill, but the act of patching something, like, leads to creativity. It makes you get creative. Like, it makes our community get creative. It's that we're kind of involved in the process of prolonging the lifetime of that garment. So we've got 3 or 4 different, probably 5 or 6 different people now that do the patching. And
you've created your own brand to patch it over, or you've just patched it over with any piece of cloth?
So we put the One Tree at a Time logo on. We stamped the logo on afterwards, which is really interesting, because it's made a kind of hyper-local brand that people are like, ah, this is cool. I want to be part of your mission. I want to get involved in your purpose. When we did start out, we were like, well, let's buy some pre-made patches to go over these logos, over these ski school logos. And I was like, I'm not happy with that, because they will be made for polyester. There's no other way to make them. And they will, I got this mad vision, you know, of a landfill in 200 years time, and on the top of the landfill is this One Tree at a Time badge. Like, that's not right. So we sort of said, well, what can we do that is the least impactful? So what we can do is we can use the fabrics that we have in our community and make our own patches. You know, like, a lot, sometimes we'll get some garments in and there'll be a big stain down one side that we can't clean, but the other half of the jacket, the fabric's great. So why don't we take that fabric and use it to patch, and then stamp our logo on, and simply just do it with an ink and stamp it on. It kind of looks cool. Kind of looks like got a bit like a graffiti image to it, because it's stamped. It's not perfect. But what we said to the people at Patch is, you do it how you want to do it. We're not fussy about what this looks like, as long as it's patched and it looks cool. And so each person that patches has almost got their own style. So everything is really like unique, one-off, got this logo on, it's kind of hyper local brand really. And that community loves it. And it's really good because when I go skiing now, I can see a lot of this product on the hill, which is really cool.
That's amazing. So who's wearing it?
Quite a mix actually. Like even, so there's an interesting thing we've done actually that has surprised me. So we received a lot of kit from a chalet company because they were cutting down their staff numbers because of Brexit. So a lot of the way organizations operate out here has changed quite dramatically because of the way Brexit has affected employment. And they gave us a lot of uniform. And at the time we were like, God, I have no idea what we're going to do with all this. So what we actually did is we patched up about 50 of them and gave them to some ski shops in resort. So I've got a friend who runs a couple of ski shops. And I gave them to him and said, right, why didn't you try rental ski gear? Because no one else is doing rented ski gear around here. Your only option if you lose your bag on a flight, for example, your only option is to go and buy new. And the prices here are phenomenal. So we did that. And he's put them in the two resorts that he's in. And one is Mirabel and one is Courchevel 1850. Now, Courchevel 1850 is probably the most exclusive ski resort, if not most exclusive ski resort, about like luxury. He actually rents a lot more in 1850 than he does in Mirabel. And he rents it to people who are traveling long distances to come skiing, who might just be here for a few days, and very, very wealthy people that can afford to buy kit, but they actually are not fussed. They'll just use something else. And that surprised me. Like, quite shocked by that, to be honest.
That's amazing. So that opens up the opportunity for conversation in these rental shops or the shops where they can say, well, what's this One Tree at a Time? Or what's this? Is it now Reaction Collective that you're branding it with, or is it still One Tree at a Time?
Still locally, we brand it as One Tree at a Time. And I'll come on to the Reaction Collective and like kind of why that happened in a minute. But yeah, we still, the sort of hyper local brand is One Tree at a Time. But it is, yeah, it's what is actually quite difficult with trying to introduce sustainability and conversation into the mountains here is that people on holiday, they don't want to talk about it. And generally, it's quite a difficult thing to bring into conversation, which I kind of get if it's your one ski holiday a year. Like, although you can be seeing it all in front of your face, and climate change is going to massively change the way we holiday and the way we ski, it's still something that you probably just don't want to think about or talk about for that week. So yeah, it's good in that sense. And I mean, most importantly, it's really helped create a lovely, vibrant community, a local community of people here that, you know, it's helped feed into that community. So I've got a lot more French friends now, got a lot more English friends because of it. When we do workshops, there's a good mix of Italian, French, Argentinian, English sat around the table doing the workshops. So there's been lots of positives from that side of it, from like building up a community. And the space is actually something really special. It's become something really quite interesting. And I think it has become really interesting because we have very much kept it fluid and structured it to whatever the community wants it to become. And so, for example, outside the front of the shop, we have a great big rail that is for children's clothing, and it's just a swap rail. Like, you just put some clothing on there and you take some clothing off it, because I've got two young children now. They've got ski gear that will fit them for this winter that will not fit them for next winter. And so I might as well swap it with someone in my community. Like,
brilliant
things like that. We have like a swap board where you can put requests up, so you can say, oh, I'm trying to find us inside in the window, I'm looking for a snowboard at the minute, can you just put it up there? And we'll like try and connect people and say, oh, this person's looking for a snowboard, do you want to give it to them or buy it off them or whatever. But we've been really good at just like allowing the space to become whatever the community wants the space to become, and that's just made it really like really exciting actually, and a really cool place to be. It's mad now. It's like during the week, it's absolutely heaving. We've got an old age person's home in the small village that has recently started to accept a lot of people with mental health issues, and they will come and hang out in the shop space. And they've kind of been placed in this space in this village that it is quite isolated in a sense. There's not really any other shops to go and buy clothing in. Like, our village is quite small. And so they've got moved there, and they might not have things like winter boots. They might not have a winter jacket, and they just come to us and go, can I have one? And we're like, yeah, we've got a garage full of them. Just take, like, yeah, here's some boots, here's some winter jacket, go take it. And so they come to that space now regularly just to chat, like just to hang out. And it's become this really cool spot. And I think because it's not a traditional shop, because we're not thinking about consuming and selling, it's not, you know, we're thinking about like, oh, what event can we have that people will come to and attend? You know, what thing can we put on that our community needs? It's got a very different relationship with our community. So it's just really well supported.
That's brilliant. The purpose isn't for profit, it's for community, and it's for building community spirit. It's fantastic. I just think about whether it's in Scotland, where my family are, or here in Austin, or even just thinking about when I lived in New York, that type of community space is just need, it's needed everywhere, because everyone's feeling the pressure, whether it be in Britain with Brexit, or whether it be because of just the impact of rising prices in inflation and the overall impact of what's been happening around the world since the global financial crash. There's a lack of community spaces. What you're building is what feels like there's an urgency to create an alternative to the system that exists at the moment that clearly is fracturing and fragmenting. And it feels like you're building something that is more purposeful and has value for the community.
I'd agree. And what I would say as well is like, we have high streets at the minute that are really struggling to function. It's actually quite difficult to run a business on a high street now. We've got some quite empty high streets all over Europe. And that's probably because the internet has, you know, taken a lot of business away from a lot of those organizations. It's made people don't go out as much, maybe. But I kind of see an opportunity to really revitalize the high street, because the things that we're going to need going forward are, we are going to need things like repair. We are going to need things like swapping and sharing the resources that are already in our community. Like, and we're going to need community. We're going to need a space where we can all come together and help each other. Like, I kind of feel quite strongly that the world is going to become much more local. Like, it's going to become much more localized. Like, I can see it in the ski shop. Like, when I was in the ski shop for the last few years, I can see the disruption that's happening to supply line. Like, COVID, Ukraine, but also as well, like, climate change is going to disrupt that supply line. I would probably say it already is. But it's going to disrupt it massively. And it was getting really, really difficult at times to get the stock in that you needed to be able to sell, because it just wasn't getting manufactured for various reasons, or supply lines were disrupted. And so we kind of need to build our economy around things like repair, around reuse, around sharing our resources that we already have, around local stuff. Because if you don't structure it that way, if you structure it just about bringing stuff to Europe or to the UK cheaply, and your economy is structured around just reselling cheap products, and they're just not on anything that's like a high, like on a, not got a skill involved with it, then if we do have big disruptions to that supply line, there isn't really much of a functioning economy. You end up with a space that, you know, doesn't have, you've not got the skills that you need within that economy anymore to be able to reuse the stuff that's there.
I mean, you're talking about just there in the ski shops. It's I suppose it's ski fashion. And we just think about the impact. You talked about landfills in Ghana. We think about the impact of fast fashion, that it's the second biggest contributor to global emissions is the fashion industry. I think the Ellen MacArthur Foundation estimated that a truckload of abandoned textiles are dumped in landfill and incinerated every second. And it's estimated that people are buying 60% more clothes and wearing them for half as long. And if that's just a fact that's related to general fashion, you know, you've got to think about in terms of just what's happening within the industry that you're servicing, which is the ski industry. And if people are feeling and are aware of the impact that's having, you're creating an alternative to the problem we're all abundantly aware of. And as you say, if supply chains are being affected by, whether it be geopolitical pressures or be because of COVID or whatever else, or just the growing awareness that there has to be an alternative, what is that? What is the alternative? And what you're building would appear to be an example that sustainability is about, how do you make a community sustainable? Not just sustainable in terms of the supply chain, but in terms of how healthy the community is, how people come together and commune and have conversation and exchange and create microeconomies. And I think what you're describing is an example that other communities can probably learn from to show that actually there is an alternative, that we don't have to be as profligate with the way that we live and what we buy and what we dispose of.
When you give those stats, and I've got quite a few more stats I could add to that, and I've learned whilst I've been going through this journey about various things about the fashion industry and the impact of it and stuff. The couple of stats that really kind of blow my mind is that in the UK each year, the equivalent of 2.4 billion t-shirts are exported in the secondhand trade. So that's like they're not, sorry, 1.4 billion t-shirts exported in the secondhand trade. Most of those head to Germany, where they are then sorted and they head off to places like Ghana, Poland, other places. I think that is actually regarded as being recycled. And the other one is that brands often will order over 30% of the stock, 30% stock more than they believe they will need, because it's better not to sell out. Like selling out means that you've kind of lost revenue on a product. So they'll traditionally order anything up to 30% more than they believe they will need. And I've worked closely with a couple of ski brands, and I can see that they're doing that. And what they will do towards back in the season is they will put those things on sale for like 70, 80% off RRP to try and shift them. Now this stuff just gets disposed of. It just gets incinerated or it just gets shipped abroad. And it's mad to see that system that we've created. And in that fashion system, I'm really struggling to spot like the winners, like the people within that system that are winning from that system. Even like someone like myself, who you would probably think, oh yeah, you're living in the West, so surely you're kind of winning from that system. You know, you've got access to cheap clothing. Actually, like I'm dealing with all the waste and all the impacts from that system. And my community is dealing with all the waste and impacts from that system. Like people are leaving this stuff in our community after they've been here for winter season or after they've been on holiday. Obviously, people at the start of the supply line, the supply chain, who are manufacturing these products, we know aren't paid particularly well or aren't living in, are not working in good conditions. Obviously, the people after us here who get to deal with the waste that we can't deal with, that stuff that they can't deal with either. So I think it's kind of frustrating from my position. So in a normal charity shop, when you drop clothing off at a charity shop, somewhere between 15 and 25% of what you drop off will remain inside that charity store for resale. The other 75 to 85% will get shipped abroad. It will get moved somewhere else. In our space, because we work creatively with the products that come through the door, like we repair them, we use them for patching, we'll use the fabrics in the school, we'll make new products out of the fabrics. We actually keep about somewhere between 80 and 90% of the stuff that's donated to our shop space, we actually keep it in store. We'll also screen print, for example, over, say we've got some t-shirts that are good quality, but they might have a stain on them. We'll actually screen print over the stain so that t-shirt can get resold. But the reason it works is because we're really creative and we've built a community around the action of keeping that product there. And you're right, it kind of works. And it's kind of frustrating for me to look at an industry and see its impact and difficult to figure out why it's been structured like that, even from a waste perspective. Like, why have we structured the waste end of the system like that as well? Why are we just shipping most of it abroad? Because if you came into our shop space with a bag of clothing, but you've had a sort out at home, you've got rid of some of your excess clothing, you've got rid of some of your things that would have felt probably feel like a bit of a burden to you. They're filling up your wardrobe space. You're like, well, I'm going to get rid of these burdens. I'm going to go and give them to someone else who will do something good with them. So my burden is gone. You know, I feel good. If you came into my shop space and give them to me, you're just passing your burdens on to me and our staff. And we then will sort through your kind donations. We will use the things that we will reuse. But there will be a large amount of that product in there that we probably can't reuse. Like it might be, you know, some of the bags we get donated with some of the damaged and stained and old garments are really, really, really unusable. But you've walked away from that system going, oh, I've done the right thing. I've given this to someone that's going to use it. That means I can go and shop and fill up that wardrobe space again. Is what I would say is the psychological repercussion of that action. Then we have to sort it and keep as much as we can. And what we will actually do, if a product is really, really bad and it is poor fabric, poor material, poorly stained, broken, we will try our hardest to make sure that it doesn't go into the clothing recycling bin that will then ship that product to places like Ghana. We just try and make sure that it goes into the landfill, because we know if we can't deal with it here in our community, because it's of such poor quality, there's just absolutely no way if we put that into a recycling clothing bin and then it gets shipped to somewhere like Ghana, someone in Ghana is going to be able to deal with it. It's not possible. We don't have the facilities in Europe to deal with it. So we try hard.
So what
to
do
make
you do
sure
with it?
Doesn't get
if you don't ship
like,
it, if you keep it, and
that's a big problem. I mean, people are working on fabric to fabric recycling at the minute, none available out there really at the moment. Yeah, obviously, if you could, I would still say do what we're doing. Try and keep that garment in its original state for as long as possible. If you can't keep it in its original state, use the materials as much as you can in your community to repair something else or to do something else. But then if you get to the end of that and you have this product that's just not usable, at some point, material to material, fabric to fabric recycling would be great. But to be honest, I don't think that's going to happen with ski gear, because it's often like two or three layers of different fabrics bonded together. So I don't know like how far away we are from that to recycle that.
If we're talking about the impact, the economic impact of what's happened with inflation, with recession, the impact on what we're witnessing everywhere around the world, which is homelessness, wouldn't there be an opportunity to actually then at least take that material and turn it into some form of, whether it be a tent or at least some sort of protective covering that people who are maybe having to live on the streets can actually get access to? So at least it's staying in, having some sort of purpose.
Yeah, I think there would be. I think you could structure an industry, like a small industry around that, to be honest. And one thing we've been doing, we get a lot of black salopette, black trousers, black ski pants. So often, you know, they might have like a stain on them, or they're from a brand in the first place, they only cost 10 to 20 euros. So actually trying to resell it and trying to give it away is sometimes quite difficult. What we'll do with those is we've been doing a project where we've been stitching several together to make a basically waterproof sleeping bag that is just a waist down sleeping bag. So what we've done is we've taken some of the ski jackets we've got, we've made these sleeping bags that go from the waist down that then attach into these ski jackets, which means you can use it on the street at night, you can sleep in it, but in the day you can roll up the sleeping bag quite easily and still wear the jacket, so you're not having to transport and carry everything around. And we've stuffed them full of ski socks because we've got loads of ski socks, and we've made them so that they can be rolled up and clipped together so that you can sit on them in the day. But yeah, I think there probably is an opportunity to do so.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think there probably is an opportunity to do stuff like that with this waste, because it's hard wearing as well. Like it's ski gear that's designed to be in the outdoors. The plastics are going to last, you know, quite a few years, if not hundreds of years, before they biodegrade fully, before they disappear. The strong materials, the strong fabrics are designed to be in the outdoors. So I think that's why we've had quite a bit of success in our space, is because we're actually working with a product that's quite durable in the first place. What we are doing is definitely more difficult when you're working with everyday clothing, especially at the moment with the quality of that product. Like the quality of the everyday clothing that comes into our shop space now is almost getting worse year on year. Like the build quality, the fabric quality, the thread quality, like the thread count in the garments is getting less and less. So that stuff is really, really difficult to work with. Whereas the things you're talking about, like the outerwear, turning it into a tent fabric or turning it into a sleeping bag, yeah, it's definitely durable.
So you created an initiative called, I believe, called Citizen Friday. Could you walk us through that?
I can. Maybe we need to go on to what happened to One Tree at a Time before I get to that Citizen Friday, because that's
yes,
actually
yeah,
part
yeah,
of
yeah. Okay.
So,
all right.
I was speaking on another podcast, and the One Tree at a Time, like I say, is working really well. It's really good space in our community. It's a joy to be there. It's self-funded, and these podcasts. Someone on this podcast asked me, like, how could we scale the impact of what we're doing? And honestly, my first thoughts is like, I didn't want to scale the impact. And there was a couple of reasons for that. One, I don't want to get into that position of opening 10, 20 One Tree at a Time spaces. There's a lot of difficulty in that, a lot of stress, a lot of hard, like really, really, really hard work to make that happen, a lot of risk. And I, I was just a bit, didn't want that to become my life in a way. And then secondly, as I said earlier, the one trip at a time space is created by our community almost. And I think taking that and transplanting it into another community isn't necessarily the right thing to do.
But I'll jump in there. You don't have to do it, but other people could do it. Other communities could take your initiative and could build something that's relevant, takes the same model of what you're doing and transplant it into their community.
And that's, I think someone else must have said something very similar to me at the time. Because the result was that we decided to form a collective, which was called, is now called the Reaction Collective. So someone did say to me, how about like a network or collective of organizations? And immediately I was like, oh, that sounds way more interesting. Like that sounds more exciting. It sounds like it can scale a lot quicker. So we decided to form something called the Reaction Collective, which is now a global network of 40 organizations. They're working within the circular economy within the outdoor industry. So they might be working in skiing, climbing. I've got conversations tomorrow with some cricket, which is really cool, but just in sports and the outdoors. And they're working to just keep kit out of landfills. So they might be doing that through repair. They might be doing it through reuse, like secondhand. They might be doing it through repurposing. So there's a few organizations in there that turn like waste fabric into things like you described, into other items. There's some companies in there that are redistributing. So they're receiving kit and they're getting it into the hands of people who want to experience the outdoors but can't necessarily afford it. And so, yeah, we started this collective of 40 organizations. Well, we started with about 7 or 8, and within a year, we've got about 40. And we share ideas, we support each other, we share materials, we share resources. We use a Discord channel to do all this, which is actually, it's a really, really, on a personal level, it's a really joyful place to be because it creates a lot of resiliency in me. It gives me a lot of hope. It makes me feel part of something much, much bigger. There's a channel on there that's called a Wins channel. And essentially, you put your win on there and then we all go and share that win for that, you know, collectively across Instagram or LinkedIn or wherever. But that Wins channel, like you can be having a pretty poor week and you thinking, oh God, like nothing's going on, this is hard at the minute, and someone shares a massive win on there. So you're suddenly part of their, you know, you're part of their story and you're like, great. Like, you know, I had a particularly hard week. It must have been 2 years ago in the summer. We had a forest fire that you could see from this window that caught in August and it ended up burning for nearly 3 weeks. It was a tough old week. Like it was a tough week to watch that, like from your window to see that happening. And it was extra tough because at the time my son Noah was only about 18 months. And you know, I just remember sitting, feeding him food, like nourishing him, like looking after him with this like forest fire in the background. And I just remember going, oh God, like this is hard. I brought a child into this world and look what's going on. That did knock me at the time. But there was stuff going on still. Like I was still part of something where some action was being taken and we were progressing and there was some movement and there was a community around me that were gathering around me to go and like there to talk to and to chat through about these things that you're feeling. And so, yeah, we've got this collective space that's just, again, a real joy to be part of. It's fun. It's creative. It's exciting.
And 40 organizations across how many countries?
So we've got quite a few based in the UK, but we've got a few in France now, New Zealand, a couple of organizations in the US, one in Budapest as well, which has just joined. They're not all running community spaces. It's a mixture. There is some community spaces. There are some not-for-profits. There's a physical shop space in the Peak District from where I grew up that we're working with, where we've introduced secondhand into that physical store, which is a really, really cool thing to be able to do to try and help them transition. Like an existing company, an existing organization that, yeah, is owned by a really good friend of mine from school. And he got in touch and said, I think this, what you're doing is amazing. Like, can you help us? We really want to change. And so there's a Reaction Collective rail in there and a drop-off space. And what we've helped them do is partner with a repair organization locally that then repairs any of that kit. And then they resell it in the store. Mostly when you drop off outdoor gear in an outdoor store, like the outdoor store will shift it. They'll ship it to somewhere else. They'll donate it somewhere else for it to be used. Whereas we want to sort of displace a bit of the new sales with secondhand.
I'll tell you a good organization that you should connect with. Well, I could try and connect you here. I'm a member of my local gym is the Y. I go into local one here down, it's called Town Lake. It's down by the Lake Austin. And they have a bin, which is a recycle your running shoes. I don't know where they go. I have actually no idea, but people donate them and they just go in there. I should find out where those shoes end up and if there's an opportunity there for, if they're working with someone that's doing some form of recycling. And because there must be an opportunity, the scale of the Y, of all the gyms, they're all over the US and they're driven by a greater purpose than profit. So they would be a perfect partner for your collective.
Yeah, and like when it comes to shoes, for example, running shoes are a difficult product, probably one of the more difficult products to get reuse from. But we have a member in the collective called Pair Ups that repairs trainers. So he's getting another 500 to 1,000 kilometers out of running shoes by selling these repair patches and how to do them and how to patch at home yourself. And so there is like skills within the collective that I believe that's kind of the point of the collective, that we can share, that we can go on a journey with Y and figure out like what is the best thing to do with them shoes. And you know, like I won't have the answers, but someone else in the collective will. Like they'll be working in that space, you know.
Exactly.
I'm focusing on outdoor ski gear.
I think the inspiring thing is it's more than just sharing your kit and repurposing it. It's the sharing of knowledge and the sharing of skills that's fascinating.
So I should have said who I set Reaction up with actually. So it's set up with co-founder is Heather. So Heather, she used to work in she used to own a chalet company here, transitioned into doing marketing in a ski school. And then after that went to the course at Cambridge University in the sustainability leadership course on marketing. And then she's transitioned into marketing around sustainability. And so Heather was obviously naturally drawn to what was going on at One Tree, and we were having these conversations and I started talking about this idea of I think we could build this collective and we could scale. And like we both said, and I thought, yeah, like this is cool, let's go with it. And I don't think when we started, and this is what's quite nice about Reaction, it's still quite fluid. Like it isn't, you couldn't really pin it down and say, I actually don't know what it's going to look like exactly in 5 years time, which I feel is its strength, because it's about our community. Like there's no, the power is completely distributed. No one has more say over anyone. Like I have no more say in that space than any other member of that collective. We're all very equal. Everyone's opinion and point of view is not the same value. And I think what we've kind of realized, and we've definitely fought this in the last 2 weeks, is we've actually created something quite special and quite interesting just by following our noses and going down this path. It's kind of naturally got us into this position. And there was one key decision Heather and I made. Like we set out and we still haven't figured out the funding exactly, but we thought at the start, well, maybe our members should pay to be part of the collective. That's where the funding should come from. Like from the beginning, I thought that was it didn't sit comfortably with me, because if I put my One Tree a Time hat on as a member of Reaction, I'm paying a monthly fee. I'm thinking, right, what am I getting back? Am I getting enough back from this organization? Am I justifying my membership? Whereas when you take away that membership fee, so when you say, right, it's free to be part of this collective, you suddenly switch to like, oh, what can I do for it? Like, what's my role to grow in this thing, to helping the people within it? Like, how do I help grow this community? Like, what's my give to this community? And I think that when we made that decision to say that we'll figure out how to fund it in another way, and that be part of this collective is completely free, you just got to get in there, muck in that. There was a switch in how it was operating, how it was working.
Yeah, because in fact, as soon as you start introducing fees, it sounds like a union. You pay your dues to be part of it and you're going to be represented. And what are you doing for me, looking after my interests? So it does, it flips it from being almost like a hierarchical system to being flat, distributed.
I listened to a podcast someone advised me to listen to the other day called Team Human.
Oh, yeah.
That was your work.
Rushkoff. Yeah.
Yeah, so I listened to the Carney Ross episode on your advice, and you advised, you said to listen to the bit about anarchism, and it was really, really interesting. And I didn't know the meaning, actually. I didn't know the dictionary definition was what it was. And in there, anarchism talks about a distributed power, a level playing field, like, and also no obligation. So I think once there was money involved, there was an obligation that we would return something, or they would get something, or, you know, I guess you might want to grade, when there's money involved, you might want a grade that you can stick on your website. Say, we're graded 5 out of 10, or we're graded 9 out of 10. Like, we actually don't want to do any of that, because we want people just to be getting on with the act of like discovering what we can do, what can come next. We don't want to be embroiled in like the act of recording data and saying, oh, this is wrong. We just want to get into creating something different and something new. And so, yeah, I think we have created something in that framework by chance, almost by accident. It's quite interesting.
Well, I'm sure at some point, you know, it will emerge, the funding model, and how, whether it becomes a philanthropic funded venture. You know, I think it is something that it will, just that solution will emerge, that you've made the decision not to make it fee based. I think that's the interesting thing. It's that whole journey seems to have been on this journey that is almost, that it started with you with one tree at a time, and it's evolved into something that's much bigger. I think the same way that you're trying to, you don't need to consciously decide what it'll be. The solution will come to you, probably through some form of serendipitous conversation or connection. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see what does emerge and how it evolves into becoming something that is not just 40 organizations, but 400 organizations across maybe 40 countries.
Yeah, I agree. And like, actually, like, we've stumbled upon loads of solutions from start to finish. Like, this wouldn't be what it would be without Heather's input. It wouldn't be what it would be without Heather's husband Andy's input. He's a website designer. So these solutions, and I think when you start to do something that's fundamentally good and positive, and it has a clear mission and a clear purpose, kind of the good stuff comes to you a bit, and it just happens upon us, because we're putting ourselves out there and saying, like, the system or what's happening in our community isn't right. We want to do something different. We want to be part of that, but we actually want to take some action. We're not just saying, you know, we're not just saying the system's really bad, someone else do something about it. We're saying, like, oh, it's not looking great, and it's not great for our community. Like, what can we start to build, and what action can we take? I think people just naturally gravitate to that. Yeah, I'm not concerned about funding, actually. I feel like it will, like you say, it will materialize some way. We'll figure it out.
What is it? What do you need the funding for? Where's the cost in terms of?
The good thing about what we need funding for is we don't need a huge amount, because it's a collective. So we need to be able to fund the core team to be able to keep things working. That is what we would like to create next, is what we're terming the toolkit, but it will not just be it will be placed on different places we've found on the internet, but a toolkit of how to set up spaces like One Tree at a Time in your own community, and the actions that we've taken, and how you can take simple steps like putting on a repair day, or just doing a clothes swap day, or even just getting your community together to watch a film, so that you start a conversation about like what your community might like to do. We want to build that next, so that there's a way for everyone to get access to the information and the stories that we have. So like, it's certainly not like, it's not crazy amounts of funding, which is the beauty of it. It's quite a resilient organization in that sense, because the power is distributed amongst all its members. If One Tree at a Time in 15 years has to close because we've lost all the snow around here, for example, like, and we don't have as many tourists here, for example, we've not been able to figure out a way of funding it. I'm sure we will have by then, but figure out a way of funding it differently. There's the rest of the collective still there. There's still stuff functioning. It's not like we've lost everything. And that feels really powerful to me as well. And it goes back to that idea of like, if you're having a bad time within an organization, or an organization struggling a bit, there's a lot of support around you from the collective, but also you can see that other good stuff is going on. So you continue, you know, you stay in the game, you keep pushing, because you can see this stuff is growing.
What you're building is an inspiring organization, which is it's in a way, what you're creating is an alternative to John Alexander, who we both know, has termed the citizen story and not the consumer story. We know that the consumer story, what he talks about, is broken and is being torn apart and is leading to people feeling disconnected, frustrated that they're contributing to a system they know is damaging to people and the planet. But people feel hopeless and helpless because they can't see any alternative. But you're creating an emerging structure that does prove there is an alternative to the consumer story, this what John calls a citizen story. And although you've got organizations that are forming part of your reaction collective, they don't have to be the ones contributing the funding for it. I mean, I came across your organization by seeing you on LinkedIn. I was like, oh my goodness, this is amazing. This is an example of what John talked about in the citizen story. You are an exemplar for it. Individuals who go to these organizations and they benefit from what they're delivering, they could be the members, they could be the contributors to it. I mean, I could see a situation where it doesn't have to be the organization in America or the organization in the one that you mentioned in the UK. It could be the people they want to be part of a new system. So I could see a way of saying, okay, I want to be a part of your reaction collective as a citizen. And I'm prepared to get access to your Discord channel to be able to read about, to be able to feel I'm a part of something bigger, not as a citizen of the United Kingdom or a citizen of the US, but a citizen as a part of the reaction collective, because I want to feel I'm contributing to a better future in any way that I can. And if that means being able to say, okay, I can afford to give $100 a year to be part of the reaction collective, so I can get access to meet the people in your network, in the reaction collective, that are local to me in Austin or local to me in Edinburgh. What I see is sort of the emergence of a network of people who are having agency in building and being part of building something that's better than existed before. If the system, as John says, we are in this transition, then it's not just organizations that have to become part of the reaction collective. It's people, it's citizens. And maybe that's where the funding model will come from.
I've said a few times recently to people in passing in meetings and stuff that we have to figure out a role for the citizen within reaction. That's kind of our next step. Like, we've got these great organizations that come together. There's more coming all the time. Now, for everyone's benefit, we need to connect those organizations with citizens, with people who want to take part in, to use their services, or even like go and volunteer with them. Like the One Tree at a Time shop here, we've got plenty of people who come and volunteer in our space because they want to get involved in that way. And we just need to be able to figure out an effective platform, an effective way to feel that you're involved as a citizen. Yeah, but I do see there is an opportunity. And I do think part of this process of setting up Reaction was definitely led by Reading Citizens. I definitely read that and had a real connection with the book and with the story. I don't think it made me go, oh, I'm a citizen. I think it made me go, remember when I used to live in the Peak District when I was a young kid and I wasn't a consumer? I was a citizen then. And then I've come to this place in the mountains and got dragged into the ski resort a bit. I'm not really a citizen anymore. I'm a bit like, my life's got a lot more about it to do. It's a lot more about consumption. And it made me go, I remember that. I'm going back there. So I've gone back to my roots a little bit. And in a sense, I feel much more like I'm a citizen again. The consumer story has never really got a grip with me. It's never really got hold of me, because growing up in the Peak District, I didn't have access to shopping. It wasn't a thing. It wasn't possible for me. The first time I lived anywhere that was near or accessible to a shop would have been when I went to university, but I didn't have any money. So I never really bought into the consumer story then particularly. And then where I live in France, because of where I live, I don't have a TV. So I don't get to see much advertising in my day-to-day life. I live outdoors in the mountains. It's easy for me to go a long time really without seeing an advert, to be honest. It isn't around me. I'm not surrounded by it. And John talks about how now some people are seeing up to 10,000 adverts a day, which I feel quite lucky that I don't experience that. So I think the book really made me go and think about that time. It made me go back a little bit to that time, and it made me question what I am as a person and my role. And it definitely fed into our work. But yeah, I think we're entering into that story of what it means to be a citizen. And I think we have to figure out like how we can fund an organization within that story as well. Because we've got nothing, we've not got something that we want to sell for people to consume as an organization. So we do have to, and maybe the thing they want is access, like you say, to the group. Maybe they want to be part of the collective.
There is a book called The Innovator's Dilemma by a guy called Clayton Christensen, who sadly died a few years ago. He discussed the concept of disruptive innovation, usually giving examples of how high-tech brands or how technology disrupts industries. When I started reading and finding out about more about what you're doing, it did feel like what you're actually doing is disruptive innovation, but in a low-tech, what I call high community disruption. Because what you are beginning to do isn't just disrupting a sector, you're disrupting traditional business models. Because if reaction as a collective scales and communities and groups emerge in different countries, in different localities, what you're going to start to see is the emergence of upcycling, recycling, resharing, swap shops happening en masse, which is actually going to force traditional businesses to evolve their business models, to embrace the type of thing that you're doing. Because they couldn't ignore it. Because they either go out of business or they evolve. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see what brands like Patagonia, who are already a brand that's committed to, you know, if you think about what they did in Black Friday a few years ago, about 10 years ago now, getting people not to actually spend money and go out and buy, but to actually repair. You know, it was a thing that got me into buying the Patagonia brand and being a committed Patagonia sort of buyer. But other brands will have to take your lead, because if they don't, the group people will start to go, no, I'm not going to buy with that brand because they're not purposeful. And I'm going to be committed to actually helping and working with my local community to make my local community sustainable. As you say, we are in a time of transition where we'll probably start to see a move away from globalization to much more locally driven sustainable economies, where craft skills start to reemerge from people learning how to use sewing machines and repairing things and creating something at a local level rather than relying on these fractured supply chains.
There's a bit in that I'd like to see Patagonia change within their model. And Patagonia have been really good at growing the idea of repair within outdoor products. It's been a really, really good the work that they've done to encourage people to repair. And they've done it by offering free repairs on their equipment for life. The repair on that equipment isn't technically free. Like the repair on that equipment I believe it comes from their marketing budget. And so then it's free to the user, to the consumer, citizen, I should say, free to the citizen. But it's not technically free. And actually, if you think of our space one tree at a time, what we would like someone that needs a Patagonia jacket repaired to be able to do is still get it repaired in their local community by someone who is skilled at doing a repair so that they can trust. And either they pay for that service or Patagonia pays for that service. Because at the moment, you still send that product off to be repaired, and you send it, so in Europe, you send it to a centralized place in the Netherlands, and that's where that repair will get carried out, and then it will go back to you. Whereas I'd much rather see us, or like Patagonia, get involved in building a network like we are, where they are actively supporting the reemergence of craft and trades within these communities. Because at the minute, they're taking that repair is taking funds out of our community, like money that could be spent here, and it's taking it elsewhere. I think you said like disruptive tech and disruptive community. I think maybe the interesting thing is that disruptive community could scale like really quickly, couldn't it? It could scale like super fast. Did maybe even John mentioned this in the podcast you had with him. Maybe he mentioned this in about the citizen story being able to emerge quickly in a sense, in the fact that it's kind of the citizen story is in all of us. It's like the oldest story. So actually, like, it could emerge really, really fast. But the same with what we're trying to do, like a network could grow incredibly quickly because it's about being a part of a community. So it's about people. If we can shape and make that space where you, Mark, feel part of the Reaction Collective in a meaningful way, and you feel like you're involved, and then your neighbor feels like they can be involved, or someone else in your town, and suddenly you can have a really quick and scalable impact. And I think that's why I said earlier, when with Reaction, what it's been really good at is we've never fixed ourselves in one position. Like, it's constantly changing, it's constantly shifting, sometimes week by week. And so we're able to move into that space. And interestingly, we did make another decision early in this process that helped that as well, is we did have some brands who manufacture stuff go, oh, this is cool, like, can we join your collective? And there would have been an option there to say yes and to try and influence what they do. But actually, we decided to say no, like, we want to remain free to do what we need to do and to go where we need to go. By all means, use the services of our members. So if you want to get, you know, if you want to find a partner for repair based in France, then speak to the guys at One Tree at a Time. Or if you want to find a partner for repair in the UK, go and speak to these people, like, use them. But actually, like, this collective is about something different. It's not about existing brands that are manufacturing stuff. Like, we want to be able to remain separate so that we can't disrupt. We don't quite want to get emerged into the system.
I know we haven't talked about Citizen Friday, but do you want to quickly cover that? Because it'd just be good for you to explain what that was and anything else you want to highlight.
Yeah, so Citizen Friday was a campaign that we ran in response to Black Friday. So Black Friday, like, when you talked earlier about the fashion industry, well, the fashion industry has integrated and has made its way into the sportswear industry and the outerwear industry. Like, people change the colors every year, they change the fabrics, they change the zips to try and encourage purchase more. And like, Black Friday is a big part of the outdoor industry. You'll see lots of sales in the run up to it. And so we decided that we wanted to sort of do a campaign against Black Friday, but something that wasn't just against it, it was something that was positive, something with meaningful action you could take. We weren't just going to say again, oh, Black Friday's rubbish. So we came up with, like, well, Heather came up with Citizen Friday. And the idea behind Citizen Friday was repair, share, and get some fresh air. So the idea was that on Black Friday itself, don't go consume, go and do these things instead. They're better for your community, they're better for you, and they're better for the environment. And actually, like, the whole campaign went down really, really well. And I think it's because it was quite simple to be involved. You could take part in it. Like, you had a role to play, and probably has caught the attention of people just because of the situation we are in the world at the minute, and maybe people don't have as much expendable cash and spend and as much money to spend and stuff, so they fancy doing something maybe a bit different. Like, maybe they want to do something that's a bit more for them or for their community. And it went really, really well, and it's continued since. Basically, I do Citizen Friday every week. I've decided that I will cram my work in elsewhere, and that on Fridays I will spend the time with my two young children, and we tend to go outside, we go ski touring, I strap them both onto my back, we go ski touring, or we go skiing, we go bike riding, and just do stuff outside that feels good for me and for my family. And we're gonna, yeah, so we continue that campaign. People are still doing it, they're still joining in, and it's a sort of stepping stone into the wider work that we're doing at Reaction. And so, yeah, it's been a really cool and well-received project. On a note of what we need, I know you talk about random collisions. Like, from start to finish, this has been one journey of random, well, it's not finished, but to start to where we are now, this has been one journey of absolutely random collisions, like, one after another, after another. We just need to keep that going. Like, we just need to keep getting into spaces where we meet people who think they might have some help, or they might have a role to play, or they might have an idea to just keep coming on this journey with us.
Just going back to what you said about you had brands approaching you, you didn't want to be part of it. What did they say that was the appeal of the collective that made them want to be part of it?
Good question. I mean, once we'd spoken to them and had an introductory meeting, it was clear that it couldn't work. So maybe they didn't know enough about what we were up to and what we were doing. At that point as well, we didn't have, we've since created a very, like, a short manifesto. It's sort of 7 or 8 points about what we do. Such things as, like, embedded in the circular, we're pushing with the circular economy, we're building communities, we're sharing skills, we're sharing knowledge. Like, once we'd built that, and it suddenly, when a brand looked at that, they realized that they couldn't really tick that manifesto. They couldn't say that they were doing all of those things. So I think probably at the time it was maybe that we were more towards the start of our journey. They didn't actually really know exactly what we were up to. We hadn't fully established exactly what we were up to.
Do you think there will be a role, potentially a role for brands become participants?
I think the best thing they could probably do is help our members, like the member organizations, like actively act with those. So there's a great organization, for example, called Kidder. And the Kidder platform is a sharing platform for children's sports gear. So you would just list your kids' sports gear that they've grown out of, and you can swap it or you can resell it. Now, they've started to work with like cricket clubs, sports clubs, football teams, professional teams that have excess kit that they don't know what to do with, and it's probably ended up in landfill, and they're starting to work with them by listing it on those sites so that children can have access to this kit. So I think like the way brands, and a couple of brands have come to us and said, look, we love what you're doing. What parts of the collective can help us with our journey? So there's like, we've had some meetings with a brand where the repair organizations are going to help on the repair side of things. The repurposing organizations, the organizations that turn waste fabrics into new products are going to help on that side of things. So I think there's a way for the collective to be involved, but maybe to be involved with the member organizations itself. But again, like, we don't know, like, this is not fixed, and maybe at some point there is a way for that to work.
So are we going to see an emergence of a new form of business structure that isn't driven by profit predominantly? And there's an acknowledgement that there has to be a business that will emerge that will have recycling, resharing built into its business model, an evolving type of business that is inherently built to satisfy the citizen model rather than the consumer story. And maybe that's what we are yet to witness, that fundamentally says we're going to actually sort of build a business that steps away from the traditional model. And that's maybe a conversation we should take offline.
I agree with that sentiment. And actually, it's part of the reason why we tried to remain separate from the industry at the moment, because we can take on that role as disruptor. And maybe part of what we do is finding out what that might look like. Like, the things that we're working on might feed into that. So yeah, it would be an interesting conversation to follow. And I think it's going to happen probably in some way or form at some point.
Maybe it's a reimagining of what the cooperative was in the UK, and going back to actually your roots in the Peak District. Maybe what you're beginning with the Reaction Collective is the foundations of a new cooperative society.
And I also think what is going to kind of, I feel it's what's kind of going to happen now or next, is that actually, like, we're focused on this sector, on the outdoor sector, but the stuff and the things we're doing, they can translate us to other sectors. And actually, like, why not like a collective of collectives? Like, why don't organizations that are working on slightly different things, but within this kind of idea of purpose being the main driver, start coming together and work like more closely? And can we create something that's fundamentally different amongst us?
Yeah, well, it sounds like lots of further conversations to be had. A couple of some personal questions. Who inspires you or what?
Who or what? I think I find just inspirational in kind of just friends and ordinary people, you know, people that are like making their way in a very complicated, difficult situation. Like, I'm inspired daily by my mates and my wife and what my friends and colleagues are up to. Like, I actually have never, maybe because I've never been that bothered by the consumer story, I'm not really that inspired by fame not really inspired by fame. So I generally just find inspiration in the people around me.
You talked about the struggle when you witnessed the forest fire last year. You're going back to what you said, you're a reluctant leader, but you are actually sort of leading us into uncertain territory. We don't know where we're going, but you have a faith in what you're doing is the right thing. But you must have to deal with those moments when you're waking up in the middle of the night with Kai, moments when most of us face our fears, uncertainty and doubt about what we're doing and where we're going. How do you deal with that on a daily basis? Or when you do encounter those doubts or fears?
I think I'm able to deal with it because I've placed myself in a collective of organizations that are doing stuff, or in a community of people that are doing stuff. I think, you know, like seeing that forest fire again, like if I'd have been seeing that forest fire last year and still just fitting ski boots, I think I would feel really, really like quite, I think I'd find that really hard and be like, God, I'm like, there's a fire out there and I'm fitting ski boots. Like what's going on? So I think in answer to that, I think the only way to sort of build that resiliency and to approach that is to build a bigger community and build a collective of people around you, rely on their support and that network, because it is tough. And it is especially, I feel it is hard for lots of people, but it is quite hard when you see that constant reminder of climate change, like on almost, it's like a weekly occurrence or a daily occurrence. And that's quite hard to have that in your brain all the time going, oh God, like, you know, for example, we have got stuff that's popping up in the garden right now that is 6 to 8 weeks ahead of where it should traditionally be. You know, we're way, like spring is way, way early. Like we're almost, if it doesn't cool down in the next couple of weeks, it's spring's going to happen in February, which is, you know, and you go out and you see that on the daily reminder of that. And that's really hard to absorb that. It's really, it's a constant thing. And I think I can only... The thing that I found that makes me be able to handle that is to be able to talk to people in my community that understand it, that are working on positive action. You know, it feels like we're doing something that is meaningful, like we're going somewhere different.
I love that term, reluctant leader. But what would you like your legacy to be?
This is a strange thing, probably, because of what I'm doing, it feels like you would assume that I really feel like I want a legacy. I don't particularly feel that I have to leave a certain legacy. I don't feel like it's something that I have to have done and left behind. It's not really why I'm doing this, I guess. Obviously, I could say I've got two young children. It'd be lovely to leave a legacy of a better planet behind. But, you know, I'm a person amongst a population of 6 billion. I don't feel like I'm that person that can play that. I can have a role. I can do something with my community. I can try and reluctantly lead and see if it takes us somewhere. But yeah, I just don't feel that I have a great urgency inside to leave some kind of legacy. I guess like I absolutely adore my two children and my time and my two children is insanely good. And I guess as a legacy, I'd like to leave behind two lovely adults, or to make sure that they grew up in a positive way. And
you mentioned you didn't have a television. So I'm assuming you read a lot. So aside from the book Citizen by John Alexander, is there any book you would recommend people pick up and read?
I'm going to give a bit of a strange answer to this, maybe. I'm going to suggest something else. I'm going to say, like, if you can, take some of that time and get into nature and into the outdoors and just have a little look at what is happening right at this moment in time. There's lots of people posting today on LinkedIn, for example, that spring has started as well in the UK, again, 6 to 8 weeks early. And I think collectively, we just need to reconnect with nature and quickly. And I think actually just getting outside, spending some time in nature would be really, really valuable. And I find a lot of value in that. Go and meet nature, learn from nature.
Okay. Well, my next question was about, is there a life hack? And I suspect your life hack would be get into nature.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's my life hack. Well, yeah.
All right. Well, certainly I'm going to be connecting you to other guests and continuing your process of random collisions. So I think there's a few people in the Impossible Network you need to speak to, including Omar Freya for sure. And I'll definitely be having conversations with the people at the Y here in Austin to see if they can take up the mantle of the reaction collective, because I think it needs to spread. So final question, who should I interview next?
So I was back in the UK last year at a conference and I met a guy called Alex Fish, and he runs a CIC called 99p Films. It's a social cinema club and you pay 99p to go. You can pay up to, I think it's up to £20, but the cheapest ticket price is 99p. And you go, and the first section of the evening is a breath exercise just to get people relaxed and in the mood. And then you watch some documentaries and they'll be around the subject. He's based in Cornwall, so he does a lot of stuff around, he's done some some evenings on organic food. They've done some evenings about the emergence of AI. They've done some evenings about the sewage problem that they have in the UK currently. And then at the end of watching the films, you have a feast. So it's usually a vegan meal that's cooked using local produce. So it's benefiting the local farmers in that area. And then you discuss. And you can do that for a 99p. And 99p from each ticket goes towards a local filmmaker to make another film documentary about a local subject. And
brilliant.
I just think it's an amazing, amazing idea. You know, like, it by being just 99p to go along, watch something, chat, mm-hmm. have some food, it breaks down all barriers to entry. Anyone can go. And I just think it's a really, really cool idea. And actually one of those ideas I think can be scaled across the globe in a similar way.
Definitely,
like a really powerful way to bring people.
That's fantastic. Is he part of the Reaction Collective?
So this is a little bit when I talked earlier that I quite like the idea of a collective of collectives. We want to build this toolkit, we want to think of ways that you could start to do something within your community. So it might be that you've put on a reaction repair day, but you might also put on like a reaction 99p film night. So we might have a set of films that you can show for free. This idea of like bringing in organizations like his into a like collective space, so that there's different bits and pieces people can pick.
Well, the same way, I mean, it triggers just the last two guests I had on, Caroline Arditi, who started a thing called the Sunshine Hour during COVID, and she now runs these dinners where she brings people in for these home-cooked dinners to build community. Edward Malkenbar Caroline's in Paris, Edward's in Holland, and he's starting the thing called the Social Impact Tour, where he's finding stories of impact and people's lives transformed, and taking it on a tour around Holland, and people coming into a theatre and then contributing to help these people, these stories, and by committing to help them. Again, it's triggering. I think what all these people are doing, they're creating a sense of taking action themselves and creating agency and a sense of their people can do things individually and collectively to transform lives in their own particular way. And I think your idea of a collective of collectives, when these people all start to, and this is what I've talked about as well, when people start to connect and hear the stories of what people are doing, like 99p films, you go, why isn't that happening in Austin? Why isn't it happening in New York? Why isn't it happening in San Francisco? Because the scale effect of that is immense, the impact it would have on communities. Yeah. So I think you're definitely onto something.
Yeah, and I think we did speak about this the other day, or we have touched in the past, and like, Noah's back. Is that the problem that one of the barriers that we have at the minute is people knowing about what we're doing, is people knowing about our story. And obviously it's great to be on things like this podcast, because it's just reaching more and more people. And we actually need a platform or a way or a space for all of these stories to get celebrated, because then people understand that there is a lot of stuff going on. Like, there's all these different things emerging at the same time, and there is agency, and there is hope. And it's hard at the minute for us as an organization to cut through, actually, to reach people, just because the traditional platforms for reaching people, say your Instagram and things, are about the consumer story. They're about selling things. And we're not selling anything other than the sits and lifestyle. It's not something that Instagram particularly wants on its platform. So yeah, if we had a way of bringing all this together and spreading the message, that would be amazing.
Well, I'm sure this will not be the last conversation we have on the subject. So I look forward to continue the conversation and helping you any way I can. So thank you very much. And and best of luck.
Amazing. Thanks, Mark.
Great.
Really, all right, really good to speak to you.
Okay, that's all for now, folks. Now here's my ask of you. Please follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or whatever player you use. Also, please subscribe to our new Random Collisions newsletter. We really are working to build a global community of action takers, action engines of people that really care about the problems that need solving. Thank you very much, and see you next time.